Good morning, folks. June 2nd, a Tuesday, the first Tuesday of the month of June. And today we sit down with the mayor at noon for 1 hour in studio. We've got a lot to talk about. There's been a lot of movement on a number of different fronts since the last time that we had an opportunity to visit with the mayor. We hope that you have enjoyed the previous two occasions that we've had the opportunity to speak with her. She's been very forthright, transparent about these issues. A lot of things happening. Coming off the heels of a successful sale 250, right? I mean, it was incredible. I talked about it just a second yesterday. Was looking at some of the videos of the ships leaving, the ships arriving, a number of videos of the folks walking along the river. I went out there Sunday morning, was out there for about 2.5 hours. It was absolutely incredible. It just really felt good about the city. Everybody was excited. And I mean, it was hot and the humidity was probably 99.999%, but it didn't matter. Everyone was out there with their kids, having a great time, just looking at the ships, just mesmerized by what they were seeing. Folks waiting in line for the tours. Got to see a lot of family pictures on Facebook and Twitter as well as Instagram. And it was just really nice to see the huge turnout. Hopefully the remaining cities turn out as well as the city of New Orleans did. I want to, again, congratulate New Orleans and Company, in particular, the head of that special project, Mark Romig. We had an opportunity to co-host the show last Wednesday talking about Sail 250. Had a really good time doing that with Mark and the entire team of the folks that pulled that all together, to include the governor's office, the mayor's office, the lieutenant governor's office, so many different people involved in that process and being able to bring it to a level of just incredible success. And the USO got to see some of what they were doing for the members of the military that were here visiting from all these different countries. Shout out to them as well. I'm not certain that there's going to be another city where they're going to have as much fun as they had here, which was really good to see. So we'll talk to the mayor about a number of issues. Dane Cialino is going to join us. Dane's a professor of law at Loyola. 4-3 decision on by the Supreme Court, which upheld a state law, Act 15, that abolished separate Orleans Parish criminal clerk of court office. We're going to talk about that case, what it stands for. A lot of people are posturing and saying that the case stands for this, it stands for that, it embraces this, it embraces that. We'll try and figure all of that out. But let me just say where I am on the issue, because a lot of folks have asked, and we always run short of time when we're in the midst of an interview, and maybe that's not the appropriate time for me to opine on my thoughts about it. I don't like the fact that we passed this bill and we made it effective immediately. I think whether you like Mr. Duncan or not, whether you believe Mr. Duncan's story or not, whether you believe Mr. Duncan was actually ruled to be innocent of the crimes that he committed, whether you believe any of that, or whether you believe, like I believe, at some point in time, he's paid his debt to society. If the law says that he's allowed to run, he runs, he wins. I think he should be able to serve his term. And if the legislature wanted to do something with that office, I believe that they should have offered him the opportunity to serve his one term and to make it effective at the end of his one term. That is my thought on that issue. I don't like the appearance of this. I read the opinion 3 times last evening. I don't disagree with the majority. I don't know that there's any prohibition on what the legislature did. There's no doubt that there was significant contemplation about the consolidation of a number of criminal court as well as civil court systems back at the time of the Constitutional Convention in the early 1970s. They specifically, as was pointed out in the majority opinion, worded things in a certain fashion to make sure that they would not have to take the traditional path in order to create this consolidation. And that contemplation was simply that it was going to be by majority vote of the state legislature, plain and simple. Not a supermajority, not a referendum, not any of the other means by which might apply in order to go and consolidate these courts. So there's no doubt that there was contemplation by the members of the Constitutional Convention, subsequent state legislatures, excuse me, as to this particular issue. It's not something that was new. And as the court pointed out in the majority, the legislatures had multiple different times that they could have taken action. They go on to say that the timing obviously doesn't look good, and maybe this is unfortunate. And I'll quote what the court says: a policy argument can be made that the legislature should have acted prior to the fall election or 20 years ago when Act 621 of the 2006 regular session initially merged these offices before it was later reversed, and that was what I was referring to before, or 50 years ago, shortly after the convention delegates first raised concern about the Orleans judiciary. And there's no doubt that even back then, during the time of the Constitutional Convention, I want to say that the population of the city of New Orleans may have been 200,000 inhabitants greater than what it is at the present time. Let's absorb that for a moment. May have been around 200,000 greater. So even then, they were contemplating that. Now, I don't agree with the detractors that have talked a lot about what they think it's going to do to the system to have 9 full-time judges, and emphasis on full-time judges, as opposed to the 12, because they're giving up 3. I'm not as concerned. The question is, are we doing full-time work? Because I can tell you that on any given Friday, if you go walk down in Criminal District Court, and this has not changed, I actually worked down there in the late 70s, Friday was Ghost Town, USA. There's 5 days to the work week. It's amazing that nothing happens on Friday. There's not a lot of courts that actually pre-try cases. There were a lot more back in the 70s than there are now. There's a whole lot of things that can be done inside that court to make it more efficient. And actually, we can work full days. We can coordinate better with the DA setting the docket and things of that nature. All of that can improve. It needs to get better. It hasn't gotten any better with 12. Why do we think that in the coming 10 years that it's going to get better with the 12 when we've had 12 forever and we're not, by any stretch of the imagination, one of the most efficient systems, courts, in the state at all? With an overrepresentation by most means of measuring the activity within that court. So what's the long and short of this story? They have no one to blame but themselves. No one to blame but themselves. And I've said this before. What do you do with a court that has a judge who didn't show up for work for a year and nobody sounded the alarms? No one. And all of a sudden, because some folks that believe this is a predatory action, maybe it is. I don't know what people's intentions are. I really don't. I don't need to know, though. Because what do you do with a court and nobody sounds the alarm and someone doesn't show up for a year? Doesn't manage their docket at all or anything else. We bring in a temporary judge, Judge Franz Ziblich. Complete transparency. I've known Judge Ziblich. I knew his dad. I've known the family for years. Judge Franz Ziblich actually represented the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office for a number of years, represented my office when I was the sheriff. I know his work ethic, especially as a judge. Now, everybody can say that maybe all the machinations of the court kind of aligned for him when he was brought in to try and clean up the mess of the court where the judge didn't show up to work for a year and collected your hardworking taxpayer dollars, right? But you know what? I think he knocked the docket down in a very short period of time, in months, in half, if not more. Now, what does that tell you? I know what it tells me is that if you really want to work at it, and if you really give a damn, and you're working hard and holding players accountable to the system, if you're worried about the right to speedy trial, if you're worried about the rights of the defendant, then act like it. Move it along. Compel the DA to move along. Compel IDB to move along. Compel all of the players to move along. There will be no delays. There will be no excuses. If you set the bar low, that's exactly what you're going to get. If you set the bar high and you're not willing to accept anything less by the conduct of the members of the bar that are practicing before your court, and you stop worrying about campaign contributions and whether or not you're going to be reelected to the bench because you don't want to be too hard on the members of the bar, then shame on you. You're getting exactly what you deserve. Exactly what you deserve. And the bar is every bit to blame as the judges. And unless and until we set the bar higher, none of this is going to change. I've been in these conversations with members of the bench where throughput mattered, jail overcrowded conditions, making decisions on whether or not I was going to release a rapist or an armed robber. At the time, female prisoners were a big problem. Segregated beds, limited space, having to make decisions about child abusers or others that were going to be released from jail because of jail overcrowding, because of the complications of the life safety code and everything else that goes along with it. Not any different than what's going on right now in the jail in Orleans Parish. And God bless Chief Michelle Woodfork. She's got her hands full. But these are the complications, the downstream implications of an inefficient court that are impacting the lives of families in this city each and every day. And we want to say that this predatory action is unjust, it's this, it's that. What's unjust is that you have not delivered what the expectation should have been all these years when you had 12 judges on the bench. That is what is unjust. Don't deflect. Don't try to blame somebody else and set the landscape now for your inability to manage your docket appropriately and to move these cases through. Look at yourself critically in the mirror and gain a better understanding as to the role that you're playing in the system and whether or not you are an impediment to this system being incredibly efficient. And if you identify somewhere where it's not, then collectively come together and change it. Step up. Be an influencer. You are an influencer. You got elected to the bench. You got elected to a job that's one of the most important jobs in this country. Treat it that way. Recognize the importance for what it is that you hold in your hands the balance of life for people, intrusion into their life for people, the alteration of lives of victims. And stop with the nanny nanny boo boo. Go to work every day. This is not a place to land. It's not mailbox money. If it takes 10 hours a day to get the job done, then damn it, work the 10 hours. It's what everybody else is doing. What makes you so special so as to there's going to be a limit as to the time that you're going to put in place? How many times, if I had a dollar for every time that a lawyer has said to me that the judge didn't even take the time to read the pretrial motions that were filed because it was blatantly evident when the judge took the bench, shame on you. You have done the system, you have done the city, you have done the litigants a disservice. You want to talk about unjust? There's no better example of unjust than that. Lack of preparation, taking the bench, have not looked at anything. Of course, you know better. You're the center of the universe, right? You know it all. You got elected, and all of a sudden, you became the smartest person on the face of the earth. And no one has anything to offer in these cases that are before you. And all of a sudden now we're going to be upset and we're going to have all these talking heads talking about how the wheels of justice are going to come falling off. The wheels of justice have been falling off in this system for decades. I don't want to hear that bull. I think the public is tired of hearing that bull. That's why when you put constitutional amendments on a ballot of increasing the retirement age to 75, it is resoundingly defeated because they're tired of hearing the bull. They want to see performance. So let's see what happens. I don't know. I know there used to be a lot of organizations that used to go sit in court and watch these judges. I hope that there would be a resurgence of that. In fact, one of the judges that's going to be removed, Simone Levine, actually worked and was the executive director of Court Watch NOLA for a long time. And, you know, she's now seen it from both sides of the equation. Maybe she'll come back and reestablish and reinvigorate and make that bigger and better of Court Watch NOLA because she has seen the other side. And maybe there's an opportunity for some more incredible, great work to be done on shining the light on what we're doing and what we're not doing and start asking the questions why so that we can find some remedial measures and actions that are going to be difference makers for this community. But the pot of gold and the rainbow is not there. We have limited dollars. And priorities need to be set. Now, I'm not saying, and please don't get me wrong, that I believe that the legislature dotted the I's, crossed the T's, and everything else that went along with this. No, they did not. They did not. And I don't disagree with that. But how many studies do we have to get through? How many times do we have to look at this? How many times do we have to listen to the excuses? How many times? The public's weary. They're tired. They don't want to hear it. They simply want performance. Right? They want performance. They want to hear about how judges are managing their dockets and how they're moving cases through, because on the criminal side of the house, it's all about throughput. You have a limited asset, a jail, with so many beds, and that's it. And you have arrests annually that are probably 5 times, maybe 6 times, maybe 10 times, maybe 15 times greater than the capacity of the jail. So it begs of throughput. Throughput through the court and efficiency, making sure that the balance of interests are served and that the constitutional protections are preserved is what's important. And all of that can be managed. There are court systems that are so much more efficient than we are. Why don't we just go figure out why? We'll be right back. Folks, it's almost really become a full-time job to stay on top of and in front of the mixed messaging relative to what the regime is saying in Iran and where we are in our position from the U.S. perspective, a ceasefire, diplomatic negotiations, trying to negotiate a memorandum of understanding, not really sure what that ultimately means and what the final document is going to look like. And Jonathan Sayeh joins us, Iran analyst with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Jonathan, you've been following this religiously every day. I don't know about you, but this, for me, this is getting harder and harder to wrap my head around where we are and why.
Hi, it's great to be with you, and you're right to point that out. Having covered this as long as I have, it does get more complex, but similar themes are reemerging in a sense that when discussing the big picture between Tehran and Washington, you seem to get some positive remarks coming from the two sides. But as soon as it's about the detail and the sequencing, more importantly, we see the clash. So right now, I think the biggest hurdle is who's going to provide the concessions first. Will the United States release some frozen assets, and then in return, Tehran would show a similar gesture? Or are we waiting for Tehran to make the first move so we know that we're negotiating good faith, and then we can maybe, in theory, reward them with unfreezing certain amount of their assets? But nonetheless, the discussions right now are limited to an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, so we're still quite far from an actual deal.
Are they worthy, in your view, of getting the concessions first? I mean, they have a long history of misdirection, leveraging, misleading, and I'll just say it, lying.
Lying is the most precise term, as you noted, and I think everything really shattered in 2015 when we enacted a deal, and on paper there were supposed to be full inspections, and then we found out there are undeclared locations where they were enriching uranium, and that misleading really policy has been going on. Of course, deception is Tehran's main strategy. That's one hand, and two is where these funds are going to end up. Let's even say we play this game with the Islamic Republic, and let's say we somehow want to appease them. The challenge there is we know those funds are going to, again, attack our bases, our forces, and our allies in the region, because one thing about the Islamic Republic, having grown up there and having been jailed in the Islamic Republic's prison system, I can tell you that the welfare of their own people has never been on the agenda, let alone a priority. So it's one, getting it to them is one challenge, and then what they're going to do with those billions is, of course, the main concern now.
So in the meantime, over the last 48 to 72 hours, we have what seems to be, although we're not characterizing it that way, that we've reengaged kinetically, right?
You can say that. I guess a better description of the status is the fire never ceased. I guess there was never quite a ceasefire. We saw the war winding down. But to see the Islamic Republic to still be this emboldened and actually launch attacks against our assets is indicative of their mindset, meaning they thought they won this war. And that is nothing short of an ideological regime that, of course, any pause against this, any pause in attacks against this infrastructure is somehow a victory to them. And what we've seen so far is that they do not change their behavior, no matter if it's during a conflict, pre or post. But you're right to point out that the kinetic engagement is ongoing. And of course, we see the instigation always be initiated by the Islamic Republic. And of course, we're just simply responding to the aggression.
We're visiting with Jonathan Sayeg, Iran analyst, with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. One of their strategies has been to bring the region into this, and they have sought and sent ballistic missiles, drones, and other armaments into the neighboring countries, I guess in the hopes of trying to create a fracture with this alliance with the U.S. Have they succeeded at all in that regard?
In certain ways, you can perhaps make the case, but in the big picture, no. So one thing that really stood out to many of us is, despite Iran attacking NATO countries, and in this case, we talk about Turkey or or Cyprus, in this case, UK bases there, we did not see any response come from Europe. So that was really astonishing. Unfortunately, maybe not that surprising given the history of appeasement coming from that continent for the Islamic Republic. And even when the regime blocked the Strait of Hormuz, Europeans were the first to pay the price. And again, we saw nothing but appeasement from them. So maybe that might be more point of a friction between Washington and the EU as a whole, especially given how much involvement we had in the war in Ukraine. But whereas it's their turn to, help us out, we see that lack of desire. But on the other hand, when you look at the regional Arab states, we see a closer coordination between them and Israel. So if there's any example for us to see why the Abraham Accords had to be done when they did, and actually we see them expand, it is in fact the Islamic Republic's aggressive policies towards the Persian Gulf Arab neighbors that is getting them closer in coordination with Israel. So that was ended up being a one really for having a regional coalition against the regime.
So when we refer to the regime, the other thing that kind of mystifies me is who is the regime? Do we know, really?
That's an excellent question. Of course, it's not a one-man show like Libya's Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein's Iraq. It's not just one Ayatollah. There are different pillars. You can maybe categorize them in two different themes. One of them is the pillars that are tasked with waging war, continuing this conflict, regionalizing it and inflicting costs on the United States. That is primarily the IRGC, the main body of the military apparatus. And the other theme is internal. So whatever asset can crack down on Iranian dissidents inside the judiciary, the law enforcement, perhaps the clergy. So what you see right now when we talk about a regime is whatever pillars that could ensure the survival of the system that's in place. And they think their survival depends on cracking down internally and waging war externally.
So if we were to have to re-engage kinetically, you know, full force, where would they go? What would they do? I mean, you know, we've bombed them pretty much into oblivion for the most part. Would we attack kinetically that internal pillar that you're talking about? Because it seems as though that's where we would get the most juice for the squeeze.
We precisely would. The way to characterize it is the regime thinks it can absorb another round of attacks if it's external bombings. So the question is not the scale of a renewed campaign, is more so the targeting of it. The president was recently announced, President Trump, that he was very clear that he did not go after the body of the armed apparatus. He went after certain individuals of leadership. Whereas you saw the Israeli campaign go after the repression apparatus. It's ultimately about emboldening the main threat against the regime. And that is not bombs, that's the Iranian people. So any campaign that would somehow aid them, talk to them, of course it needs to be on one hand public diplomacy to encourage dissidents to go out and then backing them up, whether it's going to be the drones or actually equipping them with better capabilities to confront the repressors. But should there be a new round of engagement, or at least overtly, it's really about shifting our focus and our target, and we should really pivot away from any remarks or suggestions of regime change having already been in place. The individuals that are in charge right now have been part of the regime's apparatus for a while. It's really about messaging that the end is officially near, and we are looking at somehow having a systemic transition of power in Tehran.
And, I mean, you've been there. You're familiar with the culture. Is that truly long-term achievable?
More than any other country, I think what really concerns, I guess, Americans as a whole, and of course D.C.'s policymakers, is the legacy of Iraq or Afghanistan. But the context in Iran is fundamentally different in a sense that, one, it's very populated. Iran is one of the most educated countries in the region, of per capita especially. You have a very strong women's rights movement, something you didn't have in Iraq or Afghanistan. You have a population that is inherently anti-Islamist, and that's key. So when we were dealing with kinetic operations in both Iraq and Afghanistan after overthrowing the regime that was in charge, we were dealing with Islamists because that was the only other force. But right now in Iran, the Islamists are in charge. So overthrowing them simply means we're giving way for the secular, pro-democracy, pro-American population to rise up. And, you know, talking to young Iranians as long as I do, I was born in the 90s personally, so talking to millennials, talking to Gen Z, they've been exposed to the internet. This is not the Cold War era than when we attacked, let's say, Iraq. This is a new wave of generations that have seen the life in the West, have seen America, and they risked their lives in the tens of thousands to achieve these simple freedoms. So we know where the society is headed. It's a matter of aiding that movement or suppressing it.
So going dark technologically and defeating that and pushing that back would be a huge upside in the short term then, right?
Technologically, in the sense of internet, you mean?
Yes, sir.
Correct. So the challenge with the internet is you need to have a two-pillar strategy. On one hand, you want to aid Iranians as much as you can with VPNs, with Starlink, with any internet circumvention tool. Parallel to that, it has to be degrading the regime's censorship capabilities, which a lot of it is getting imported from Beijing. So, of course, you have to confront the relationship between Iran and China that is the main architect behind the regime's repressive capabilities. So restoring any internet access in the short term, again, would be huge. It would have a major impact. But this is to say that internet is not the only asset here. There's right. also satellite dish channel. There's also radio. There's other ways to get information inside Iran. The main challenge is, one, getting information from Iran, and two, connecting Iranians to each other during times of crisis.
One of the things that's troubling me at this kind of crossroad where we find ourselves today is the insistence of the regime of the salvation of Hezbollah in Lebanon. How do you interpret what's going on there?
Let's look at Tehran's demands prior to the war. They were under the impression that maybe they might somehow get a deal that would mean they need to dismantle their nuclear program, and then they would get sanctions relief in return. Now you look at their demands, it's not even comparable to the pre-war. So you're talking about an ideological regime that is increasingly more paranoid and sees concessions as weakness, so they're going to maximize their demand. And in the particular case of Hezbollah, they are capitalizing on the president's eagerness to stabilize the region as a whole. They realize that the chokehold, the Strait of Hormuz, the Bab el-Mandeb that is controlled by the Houthis effectively, and Lebanon and the Levant, as a whole is creating this image of chaos, something that Trump wants to address. So the message from Tehran is rather more clear that now the stakes are much higher. We want significantly more reparations and incentives for stabilizing the region as a whole. They're trying to play into President Trump's instinct to really get something long-lasting in the Middle East. But again, this is nothing short of a regime that is miscalculating its hand. They're under the impression that they have more cards than they actually possess.
So diplomatically, when do you know enough is enough? I mean, I know you're always, you know, have that channel or the back channel open, but in an overt way, when does the president go to the podium and say, okay, we're done?
The president effectively did that prior to the war, which led to two rounds of attacks. So in June 2025, the 12-day war was because, one, the Islamic Republic did not negotiate in good faith. The president ordered the strikes, Operation Midnight Hammer. And then again, we saw that on February 28th. And now we're at the third stage where the president clearly noted that even if he does not get a deal, even if he sees that enough is enough, he will simply maintain the economic pressure on the Islamic Republic to the point of either collapse or concessions. So the blockade of Iran's ports is having a major impact on the regime's economy. And this reminds me of one of the tweets sent out by the president. I think it was before he was elected, when he noted that as part of art of the deal, it's important to know when to walk away from negotiations. And it seems like Trump is already entertaining that option. The real question is, what are the consequences for Tehran should we walk away from a deal? Are we simply going to maximize maximum pressure, pair that with maximum support for the Iranian people, or is there going to be a military campaign? Or are we going to authorize the Israelis to maybe conduct some covert operations? The options are there.
Right. It's going to be interesting, and it's changing by the moment. In fact, probably has already changed since you came on the show 20 minutes ago. So that's probably a better bet than Secretariat. But thank you so much for joining us, Jonathan Sayeh, Iran analyst with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Have a great week.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.